Okay, well, welcome. If you're just coming in, if you've been here for the duration, we're pleased that you're absolutely in the right place. Our next presenter this evening isn't from around here, and you'll tune into that as soon as you hear her speak. Aunt Mama comes from the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia. And she'll be telling this summer at St. Edward's Park over in Kenmore. There's going to be a storytelling series over there, and so you'll have a chance to hear more of her work. Please welcome, from the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, Aunt Mama.
Thank you. That's not quite a storytelling series this summer. It is the Kenmore Summer in the Park Music Festival that KBCS and the City of Kenmore put on. It's wonderful, and it's free on Thursday nights. I am Aunt Mama, brought into this world as Marianne Moorman, raised in the Blue Ridge Valley, Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, and I am a storyteller. And I know I'm a storyteller because the kind people at KBCS have allowed me to tell stories this past year. I found that out. Any of you all listen to KBCS? We certainly appreciate that. And please say hi, so because it's hard to see your faces on the radio. Hi. And if Bob's here, I am going to finish that story for you. You are incredibly loyal listeners on Sunday. Some of you all start calling in the station about 6 o'clock in the morning, and you keep calling in, and you keep your dial set on 91.3 until you turn it to KUOW to catch the Americana on Sunday night. And for those of you who listen, you'll hear a few stories tonight that you possibly have heard before. And for those of you who haven't, let me welcome you to the midpoint of the last century. That would be sometime around 1952, most of these. With people who were born in the late 1800s, who would have been my great aunts and uncles. And we're going to spend a little time with those folks that brought me up. And when I was trying to pick out the stories for tonight, I realized that the people that raised me were awfully strong-minded, strong-willed human beings. You probably have some people like that in your family. My daddy used to say that I was mule-headed. That would be close to stubborn. And when I think back at my family, I can only wish that he was alive so I could look him in his blue eyes and say, I certainly came by it honestly. And this first story tells a little bit about one of those characters who had a will of her own. And the story is called Oil Can. Her name was Aura, but we called her Oil Can. Aunt Oil Can was already ancient when I inquired about her reputation. She creaked in a crackling willow rocker on the porch, and her leather-bone fingers were collapsed over her calico skirt. I sat cross-legged on an apple crate to talk to her, and I could smell the rose water she had splashed on her face early in the morning. Her age made her a little frightening to me, and I swallowed to ask, why? Why does everybody say Aura Can? And they did. It was a family saying. If you whined about your chores or your homework or any old thing that the grown-ups wanted you to do, they'd look at you and say, well, if you can't do it, Aura Can. And the cousins quickly turned Aura Can into Aunt Oil Can. Well, I didn't know what Aura could do or what she had ever done to deserve such a reputation in the family lexicon. And I was fixing to find out. Aunt Aura, why does everybody say you can do anything? And she looked out from me under her weathered old hat. And she grunted. And she had these magnified glasses that made her look like bug eyes from cataracts. She said, "Can't do everything, just do some things." Well, that was no answer at all. So I wanted her to really tell me, and I asked her again, "Well, what are the some things that you can do?" She looked at me. "Well, I can talk to spuds. I can hear it when they hurt." I was on the edge of 1,000 questions, but right then my daddy found me pestering this old woman, and he shooed me on home. Now, Daddy just wanted to go prune his Gettysburg tree, and he clipped the heavy limbs, and I asked, "How come you always talk about what Aura can do?" He ignored me, so I followed him around the tree like a shadow. "Can she really tell when a potato hurts?" I asked him. Daddy snapped the suckers in between the branches and told me, "Well, the old folks say she hears crops talk, and once she saved everybody in Windy Gap from starving." It seems that one spring, Aura dug up most of Windy Gap all by herself. It had been one of those cold, cold, snowy winters, but when the spring arrived, it arrived like a fierce, hot fire. Cherry blossoms exploded, and those yellow charred flowers were like chariots racing across the winter garden. It was warm. It was hot real early. And volunteer potato plants started to sprout up. Potatoes were gold in that part of Virginia, and every family grew a couple of acres, one to sell, one to keep to feed the family. Well, if those potato crops failed, a whole family could fail. And there were enough people that lived in the Blue Ridge Mountains who were from the Irish potato famine that everybody had a real serious appreciation for a sick potato. There were too many volunteer plants coming up for Aura. She didn't like it. She figured the forgotten tubers from last year's crop could rot during the spring rain. She studied the tiny early leaves like a mama with a newborn. She fretted over each new plant, and one night, she got out her shovel. Daddy was still clipping around the Gettysburg tree, and he told me how Aunt Aura couldn't convince folks that disease hid in those leftover seed potatoes. So she got out her shovel and started digging. Dug up the old volunteer plants, and if she found gray blotches, she set the whole plant on fire. Old man McCratchin had 20 acres of potatoes, and he thought she was tetched in the head. Said she was a witch what didn't know nothing. Well, Daddy said most of Windy Holler thought that Aura was listening to potatoes talk too much and it had confused her brain. But nobody could stop her. She dug up her family's 2 acres and burned the blackened spuds. Then she started in on the neighbors' fields. Well, the neighbors were furious and ordered Aura off their land. McCratchin threatened to shoot her, and one night he actually aimed a double-barrel shotgun right at her. Aura shouldered her shovel, but she yelled at him, "Sick potatoes blow in the wind and will wipe everyone out." And when the new sheets leafed out and turned into a brown crinkle, McCratchin knew Aura had been right. He shelved his gun and got out his shovel. And they dug. They all dug. They had early blight, and blight can destroy an entire crop. Every farmer in the holler got out his shovel and her shovel, and they began digging. Potato fires burned for weeks. You could see the glow over the Blue Mountains. Baking soda filled the holes that once held the infant plants. No one made fun of Aura after that. They followed her lead and saved themselves. And all the children in the family still learn about what they can do from what Aura did do, one shovel at a time. Thank you very much. This Next story is probably reminiscent of things you've heard before from Uncle Remus or Aesop's Fables. Not because I took it from that, but it's a daddy tale, and I think my father was raised on those fables, the Bibles, and Reader's Digest. This is called Lessons in Cake. My father was fed large helpings of stories that he digested and believed. He lived for sharing. If there was food on his plate, you'd have something to eat. If he had a dime, you could have a nickel. And if his children weren't born caring souls, he would teach us how to care and share, even if it meant eating some of our arguments. During one winter cold spell before I had started school, snow lay over the Blue Ridge like a bridal gown. Mama wanted to warm us by baking one of her sweet treats, and she was going to bake this yellow chocolate pineapple cake. She asked my big brother, Shaq, if he would watch me so I didn't burn the house down while she was baking. And I'd only caught the house on fire once, but she was never sure it wasn't going to happen again. Shaq loved cake. He loved the chocolate, and he loved the pineapple in this cake. And he knew that he couldn't get it unless he watched me. Well, Daddy heard the offer, and Daddy loved cake, so he handed my brother, Shaq, the big can of Tinker Toys, like an order. Shaq and I built tiny Tinker Toy tanks at the kitchen table while Mama mixed these magical ingredients into yellow goop. And Daddy went down to the basement to stoke the fire out back to burn. Shaq and I hid troops behind maple syrup cans, under the paper napkins, between sticky mason jars. Bam, 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 Shaq would fire at me, and I fired back. Even if he was 10 years older, I was going to not be defeated. He chased me up the stairs, under the beds, over the sofa, around the kitchen, trying to wear me out. And the whole house was perfumed with sugar, pineapple, and the chocolate trinity. The louder the smell, the more Shaq wanted that cake. Mama, he said, how much longer? And Mama told him, well, it's got to cool before I can frost it. Shaq was about to start to complain when Daddy scuffed on through the kitchen door. His jacket smelt of coal dust, and his hands were smudged ebony. But he smelled that cake, and a smile broke out over his face. He praised the Tinker Toy, knowing that Shaq had helped me and that Shaq was probably getting bored. Daddy looked at Shaq and said, why don't you go get a deck of cards and play fish for a while? And before Shaq could argue, Daddy wagered him a bet. Whoever wins the first 2 out of 3 games gets the first slice of cake. And Shaq ran off to go fetch the old crumpled up bicycle cards. The adults had learned by this time that they could get us to do about whatever needed doing if they could make a game and a bet out of it. There are a lot of wagers held at my house. And I was just beginning to realize that whoever was older and bigger usually won the bet. But I couldn't figure out how this one could lose. There was plenty of cake to go around, so Shaq came and we started to play. He took the first hand, and he probably let me win the second hand, and we took a break to lick icing before the third hand. Oh, the smell was getting stronger and stronger, and Daddy even started drying dishes just so he could stay close to the stove. I dealt the last round, and Shaq demanded all my eights, then all my twos, then all my queens, and then he got all my cards. So Mama got out that toothy kind of cake knife and sliced down through that so rich chocolate coating. She gave Shaq this crumbly big piece of first cake, and then she cut one for me. His piece is bigger than mine, I complained. And Shaq just looked at me and said, I'm older and I'm bigger, and besides, I won the bet. I launched into a chorus of, don't care, not fair, gonna put cake in your hair. And before I could climb over the table, Daddy's big hands reached up and took both of our cake plates. And Daddy starts studying these two plates with biblical kind of concern. "Well, there's only one thing to do," Daddy said. And he took a bite of Shaq's cake. Shaq, of course, wails. Daddy looks at me and says, "Well, I probably have to take a bite to even this piece up." And he took a bite of my cake. And then he took a bite of Shaq's cake. And then he took a bite of my cake. And then he took a bite of Shaq's cake. Until there were two plates of crumbs. "Now," Daddy said, "you don't have anything to argue about." And we didn't. And we didn't argue in front of Daddy any more. And the real punchline of the story is, there's some lessons that you will taste for the rest of your life. When Babe Ruth was not playing baseball, he had a favorite game that was developed by a group of hunters in Baltimore. And this story is about the game that they invented. It's called duck pins. The people in Roanoke, Virginia have two kinds of generosity. There's the first, which is that sort of just everyday, regular Southern hospitality. And the other kind is the give you the shirt off their back, give you their last nickel, give you a body part if they need it. And I learned about this kind of generosity at a bowling alley. Now, this isn't the all-star bowling lanes that we have today. No, I'm talking about the kind of place servicemen took their best girl during World War II, and nobody cleaned it since 1947. Victory Lanes was so old and so tired, the wooden floors sagged, and snow could fall through the cavernous openings in the front door. And the clientele had the same haggard look. Crippled and decrepit old railroad men could pick up tip money there. They'd set the pins up, wipe the bar, or empty the spittoons. This kind of place raised the hackles on my mother's idea of respectability and acceptability into the social world. But my father thought it was just a fine thing to do with his children on a Saturday afternoon at noon when he had just gotten off from work. "She'll learn to add," he told my mother, and paid his quarter so we could get the line score sheet and the little stubby pencil. And I think we rented our shoes for about a dime. Mama called Victory Lane seedy, but I thought it was more fun than the Howdy Doody show on the new TV and a lot better than the mid-century monotonous Crystal Spring Elementary School that I went to. My brothers were in high school by this time, so it was just me and my daddy and mama strolling through these smoked-out gray doors and into the light of pool tables, pinballs, and a bowling game that was up on a table. The regulars hung out at the bar, and a guy named Stumpy hollered to us when we walked in. You couldn't see him because he was up behind the pins all the way down at the end of the lane, but he'd yell out, "Howdy, Mr. Mormon." Stumpy was perfect for this job because he was short and he could avoid getting hit by the flying bowling balls. At first, I thought he was a midget, but Daddy said no. The brakes failed on a boxcar, and it cost Stumpy both his legs. Daddy would tip Stumpy his felt hat and say, "Howdy back, Mr. Stump." And then we picked out our balls. And Daddy made me roll duck pins until I was 6 years old. Duck pin bowling, well, the balls are just a bit bigger than a softball, or if you play bocce ball, it's about that size. And the actual pins that you hit down are 3/4 the size of regulation. And I could roll my little 2-pound ball all 60 feet down the maple lanes and keep it out of the gutter most of the time. But I could never make the pins fly like ducks. And that's where the game got its name. Some Saturdays, Mama opted to have some peace and quiet. And Daddy and I got to go by ourselves. Well, that was the best. Because we only got to bowl when Mama was there, but it was just me and Daddy. We got to play the games. We got to bowl. We got to eat. And we got to talk to all the guys. When Daddy and I went alone, Stumpy rolled out to talk to us. He wheeled around on a platform that was made out of 2x4s, and it had, well, roller skates glued to the bottom. He could steer or stop or speed like thunder over the wavy floorboards with his knuckles. And he'd bring me a Coca-Cola crate so I was tall enough to stand up to the pinball machines and hit the flippers, or I could sail the steel puck with the red dot on it across the sawdust in the bowling table game. Stumpy taught me how to bank a shot and take down a split. Mama would skin us alive if she knew we were associating with the likes of Stumpy. And Daddy used to say to me, "You better not ever say squat." And I didn't. Well, one peace and quiet Saturday, Daddy didn't come home from the railroad till real late because there'd been an accident. And Mama had a headache or something, and she really wanted him to take me away, anywhere, away. And we were driving through thick, wet clouds. The air felt cold. We were on our way to Victory Lanes, but Daddy looked worried. And I asked him what was wrong. "I need to be at the hospital with my men," Daddy said. And little puffs of clouds like cold air pillows came out of his mouth. "Well," I told him, "I could bowl with Stumpy, and you could come back and get me," with all of my 5-year-old confidence. Daddy must have been more worried about his men than he was about getting skinned alive by Mama, because he gave Stumpy some folding money, and he left me there. Well, this was wonderful. There's one old geezer in a Westinghouse jacket, and he was trying to teach me how to slide into a shot. And then they were trying to teach me how to make those pins fly like ducks, but I was too little. We tried for about 3 games, and I was really kind of exhausted. And I was kind of noticing it was getting dark, and Daddy still wasn't around, and I was tired, and I looked through the window, and snow had started to fall. Snow was collecting on the sidewalks, and there were no cars driving down the road. My caretakers stared out the window, and they stared at me, and they stared out the window, and they stared at me. "It's okay, guys. Daddy will come back for me. I'm sure he will." We ate. We slid the red dot down the machines. We ate. Lights flashed and bells went off on the pinball machine, and we ate. And still, there was no Daddy. It was 2 hours and 12 inches of snow before my father, looking like a snowman, walked in. All the men huddled around him and asked the burning question, "How you gonna get her home, Mr. Mormon?" And nobody knew until Stumpy had the answer. He started telling folks what to do, and all the guys went into action. Stumpy flipped over his platform so the wheels poked up, and it looked kind of like a toboggan. Mr. Westinghouse piled potato sacks from the fried potatoes and could keep me warm and wrap me up. Somebody found a fan belt and made a rope tow, and Daddy pulled me out into these streets that looked like mountains of mashed potatoes. The snow fell so fast, I couldn't even see Daddy in front of me, but I could hear him. He sang his one-note rendition of "Home, Home on the Range." And when he wasn't singing, he was telling me how the Cisco Kid might ride up any minute. Possibly Trigger, bringing Roy Rogers, could come. And I fell asleep listening to his singing and his talking and his rubber galoshes sloshing through the snow. Shoo, 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 shoo. when I woke up. The snow mountains were so tall, it pushed our front door shut for several days. Mama baked pies for a week, and it was a lot like a Thanksgiving time, only without the turkey. I asked Daddy how Stumpy was getting around, and Daddy told me not to worry. Stumpy was fine. I never knew when Mr. Stumpy got his platform back from our woodshed. One day it was gone, just like Victory Lane's. It was gone. But what stayed forever was a memory of a whole lot of snow and a man who had no legs that would give you the shirt off his back. Thank you very much. You're very kind. Thank you for signing. I'm looking at you. And this would be the story that I didn't send you. It's not a fair thing to do. It's not a fair thing to do to the signer. If you like the music you listen to on Americana on KBCS, you have a wonderful young woman to thank, whose name is Christine Lindy, and she is the American Music Program Director, and I'm probably giving your title wrong, and I'm very sorry. And she always tells me, you know, to quit worrying about my stories and just tell them. So I asked her when she came in if I should do or I should do and she said, for God's sakes, just tell the story. So Christine, this is called Sing Out. All of us talk to ourselves. We tell ourselves good things, and sometimes the not so good reverberates in our head like an old phonograph record that's gotten stuck in the groove and goes around and around. You know how that is. And it's unfortunate because we have the whole world to tell us what we do wrong and steal away our can do. The first time I told my mama I couldn't sing, she nearly dropped a plate of chicken. We were headed to a social at Windy Gap Methodist Church, and the fourth grade choir had to perform. I was about 10 years old at the time, and I had just discovered that while most of the girls stretched in their patent leathers to reach those high notes, my voice did not obey. Mama looked at me like I had big measles bumps popping out on my face. What do you mean you can't sing? You talk, don't you? You can sing. And she put her hand on my forehead to see if I had a fever. I told her that Bonlita Dorsett, told me after the last practice of Precious Lord that I sounded like Tennessee Ernie Ford. Girls were not supposed to sound like Tennessee Ernie Ford. I knew this was bad. Mama said to me, you aren't a soprano, but that doesn't mean you can't sing. And she hustled us into Daddy's biggest Sunday black Ford so we wouldn't be late to put on our robes for the performance. We drove through white carpets of cherry blossoms, and Daddy started on one of his one-note songs, and he happened to pick 16 tons. What do you get? Our brothers joined in with their warbly boy voices. And Mama turned to the back seat and said, I can't hear you. I said back to her, I'm not singing. Well, Daddy eyed me in the rearview mirror, and both brothers started laughing, knowing I was going to be on the losing end of whatever argument I was getting myself into. Mama balanced the sweet, sweet, wonderful smelling fried chicken on her lap and whipped her head around to tell me to stop this foolishness. She stopped herself in mid-whip. What was your first instrument? She said. Well, I thought that was a trick question that was going to end in a tongue lashing about how I hadn't opened my Red Thompson piano book all week. Your first instrument was the one the good Lord gave you, the one in your throat And the boys started to laugh. Oh, Bonalita's right, Mama. She can't sing. And Mama told them if they wanted to eat any of that chicken, they should change their tune. Then my brother Ken started to open up and tell some baby stories. Her second instrument was the drum. Ken reminded us of my wooden spatula that I played on a Maxwell Health coffee can. The boys laughed. Mama glared at them until they hushed, and she held tight to the plate of chicken. I don't know who put this foolishness in your head, but get it right on out, she told me. You can sing. If and you can talk, you can sing. And God wants to hear from everyone. Make a joyful noise unto the Lord, she said. Remember? And Daddy just sort of gave her an amen on that one. Well, Bonalita Dorsett did not know that the Lord wanted me to sing. I tried to tell my parents that I didn't sound like the other girls whose voices floated higher and higher on the hear my cry, hear my call, take my hand, lest I fall. Daddy just blew up his big cheeks and said, oh, fooey, and drove faster to the Red Mill Church. Well, we were headed on over to Windy Gap, and the chicken was making the car smell so good, and Mama was explaining for the umpteenth time how our family eked out a living in the Virginia Hollows, and music was their only entertainment. Everyone played. Everyone really did play something back in those mountains, and for instruments like the dulcimer or the lap harp, you didn't even have to read music to learn how to pluck wires across a soundboard. You started strumming when you were old enough to sit still and somebody put it in your lap. Everybody played spoons and had their favorite sets. I still have a small wooden set of spoons that my daddy had given me. Daddy was ready to get to that church, and he peeled onto the red dirt church road, and we bounced to a stop, and everything was spring. It was yellow in the mulberry trees, and all the world smelled like lilacs. And as soon as I got out of the car, there's old Bonalita Dorsett prancing up the church stairs carrying her robe. Mama saw the kids with their robes and asked where mine was. I was quiet. I was coughing quiet. Where's your robe? Daddy repeated and took the chicken plate into his own protective custody. I mumbled something about not singing and therefore not needing it, and Mama looked like she was going to skin me alive. And then Daddy started to sing, Precious Lord, take my hand. Least I fall, help me stand. And Mama smiled at him and his one note. If you want any of this chicken, you'll sing so I can hear you, Daddy said. Well, Mama took my hand and led me to the big wooden choir closet. She slipped a black cotton robe over my head and whispered in my ear, Don't let anyone ever steal your song, honey. So I sang out that day, and was mighty glad I had a hand to hold, and I've been just mule-headed enough to sing ever since.
Aunt Mama.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, and thanks for listening. And I think if the good Lord willing and the creek didn't rise, if you go to auntmama.com, there's actually a website, and you can get stories. And if you want to hear more of them, it's 91.3, 8:30 on Sunday morning. And thank you, KBCS, and thank you, KUOW.